Welcome to the Lowdown. This is an AI-generated open-source news summary for general informational awareness. This product is not intended for use as official intelligence. The views expressed here are solely those of the cited authors and do not reflect the official policy or position of the Department of War, the United States Air Force, or any other U.S. government agency. So, imagine a scenario where a single drone strike halfway across the world just, you know, makes your energy bill spike overnight, or where a confrontation with literally wooden oars in the Pacific dictates the movement of multi-billion dollar naval fleets. For your situational awareness today, we're doing a deep dive into how deeply connected our global conflicts have really become.
Escalating tit-for-tat strikes between U.S. and Iranian-aligned forces are expanding across the Middle East, AOR, directly impacting global energy markets and maritime security. In the European theater, the Russian offensive maintains its maximalist aims amidst confirmed reports from U.S. officials of Ukraine's first F-16 air-to-air kill against a Russian fighter. Concurrently, in the Indo-Pacific, physical confrontations between Chinese and Philippine vessels in the South China Sea have prompted renewed U.S. diplomatic condemnation.
Okay, let's unpack this operational picture. I want to start in the Middle East because, well, we need to really understand the mechanism here. We often hear about active combat, you know, kinetic military actions, as if they exist in a vacuum.
Right, they definitely don't.
Exactly. There's a direct, immediate ripple effect from these strikes right onto global economics. Like, we were talking specifically about your energy supplies.
Yeah, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the maritime security environment in that region isn't just, you know, degrading. It's actively reshaping global trade routes.
Right.
We're tracking extensive open source reporting on Houthi attacks targeting Saudi oil tankers.
Right.
Defense reporting indicates that the Houthis are claiming strikes on two vessels in the Red Sea. And this isn't just harassment. They're using a coordinated mix of ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and drones.
And we have corroboration on that, too. Maritime trade organizations confirmed an attack took place about 70 nautical miles southwest of Al-Shuqaik in Saudi Arabia. At the same time, the Saudi transport authorities put out a statement identifying one of those targeted vessels as the Ancilia.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. They noted the ship suffered a bow fire from the strike. Thankfully, there were no casualties among the crew. But, I mean, the economic shockwave from a burning oil ship is huge, right?
Massive. I mean, the economic impact is moving from theoretical to highly quantifiable, like almost overnight. If you look at the shipping data compiled by defense analysts, at least seven massive commercial vessels have entirely changed their course to avoid the Bab al-Mandeb Strait.
And just to clarify for everyone listening, the Bab al-Mandeb Strait is a massive maritime choke point. If you can't go through there, you are taking the incredibly long, incredibly expensive detour around the entire continent of Africa.
Spot on. And we actually have the numbers on that drop-off. Trade intelligence data shows that daily crossings in the Strait of Hormuz have dropped by 31%.
Wow.
Yeah. And crossings in the Bab al-Mandeb Strait are down by 34%. So when a third of the world's commercial traffic just vanishes from a primary artery, the markets react violently.
Which brings us to the pump. Recent market reporting shows that Brent crude oil just hit $100 a barrel for the first time since May. That is a sudden 6% spike.
Right.
And analysts are directly attributing it to these attacks on shipping. But here's where it gets really interesting analytically. Saudi Arabia isn't just sitting by.
No, they're not.
Defense tracking notes they are actively diverting millions of barrels of oil every single day via pipeline to their Yanbu port on the Red Sea. They're basically trying to physically bypass the hostilities in the Persian Gulf.
It's a massive logistical workaround. But we also have to flag a developing claim that could complicate that even further. Joint Maritime Information Centers are reporting that regional sources say Iran has instructed the Houthis to be ready to close the Red Sea oil route entirely.
Entirely? Like, how does that even work?
Well, the claim suggests they are preparing for a total area denial operation if the United States strikes Iranian power infrastructure. They are essentially holding global shipping hostage as a strategic deterrent against U.S. strikes.
And speaking of U.S. strikes, the operational tempo is not slowing down. Based on military announcements, the U.S. just concluded its 12th consecutive night of strikes on Iranian targets.
Right. And the stated objective there is straightforward, you know, degrade Iran's ability to attack civilian mariners and commercial vessels.
Yeah, the target list they are hitting is extensive and highly specific. Open source intelligence details that U.S. forces hit installations at Bushehr Airport and Larak Island. They also struck the Bikranian barracks in Beibahan. But What's fascinating here is the strike on the Parchin military complex near Tehran.
Yeah, the Talegan II facility specifically. Analysts flagged something super interesting about that site. They noted that the facility is currently receiving a new concrete roof.
Which is incredibly telling, right? You don't pour a massive concrete roof on a military facility unless you are actively trying to harden the site against future strikes.
Yeah.
Specifically, you know, bunker-busting munitions. It shows they're digging in.
Exactly. And alongside those strikes, we're seeing some major U.S. posture adjustments in the region. Defense tracking shows the U.S. evacuated aircraft from Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar, moving out transports and refueling tankers.
They've also pushed dozens of refueling planes into Israel, right?
Yeah, they have. But the asset movement that really stands out is the deployment of EA-37B Compass call jets toward the region, which observers tracked via flight data.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, these aren't bombers. These are highly advanced electronic warfare aircraft designed to completely jam and scramble enemy communications and radar networks.
So they are essentially preparing the airspace.
Mm-hmm.
But this escalation comes with an escalating human cost. It was recently reported that three U.S. Army soldiers, First Lieutenant Tyler Feehan, Private Isabella Gonzalez, and Sergeant Angel Ramprasad, were killed at Mowafak Salty Air Base in Jordan.
Right. And a fourth soldier, Sergeant Michael Emmanuel Swinton, was killed in Erbil, Iraq.
Yeah. And following the dignified transfer ceremony for those soldiers at Dover Air Force Base, reporting shows that President Trump vowed retaliation. He explicitly threatened to destroy Iranian bridges and power plants, including those in Tehran, for any attacks on ships in the Strait of Hormuz.
And, well, that rhetoric immediately triggered a response. Iranian-connected media issued a counter-threat stating that Iran will target regional infrastructure and energy facilities that hold American interests if the U.S. follows through on striking Iranian bridges or power plants.
This isn't just verbal escalation either. The geography of the strikes is physically widening. Intelligence analysts are tracking Iranian strikes on multiple coalition bases.
Yeah, we're talking Ali al-Sulam and Bubiyan Island in Kuwait, King Abdulaziz Air Base in Dahran, Saudi Arabia, and King Faisal and Prince Hussein Air Bases in Jordan.
Fortunately, Jordanian air defenses successfully intercepted 4 out of the 6 incoming missiles there.
Right. And the secondary regional impacts are really rippling out. For example, reporting indicates Hezbollah is now claiming that Lebanese Shia are facing discrimination at Beirut's Rafic Hariri International Airport.
Which is likely a calculated narrative designed to remobilize their base of support.
Exactly. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio publicly dismissed the possibility of Syrian military intervention in Lebanon. And internally in Iraq, the prime minister just appointed Lieutenant General Zaid Hoshi al-Musawi to lead the counterterrorism service alongside a new federal police commander.
Okay, so looking at the strategic geometry of these blockades, I have a question about this symmetry here. Do the intelligence sources assess the U.S. naval blockade on Iran as having a disproportionate or symmetrical economic impact when compared to the Houthi blockade on Saudi ports?
That's a great question.
Because it feels like the U.S. controls the water, but Iran is still, you know, finding a way.
It's definitely an asymmetric workaround. So to bypass the maritime choke point created by the U.S. blockade, reporting shows that Iran is rapidly expanding its land-based trade with Pakistan.
Right.
The Iranian Interior Minister actually just announced an agreement targeting $10 billion in bilateral trade. They are utilizing vast land routes to completely circumvent their restricted access to the sea.
Which perfectly illustrates how global military logistics are having to adapt in real time. And, well, that brings us to the European theater. The immense strain on layered air defenses is a critical focal point in both the Middle East and Eastern Europe. But in Ukraine, we are looking at a historic aviation milestone.
We really are. According to defense reporting, General Dan Kane, the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, confirmed to lawmakers that a Ukrainian F-16 shot down a Russian fighter jet for the first time.
Yeah, open source analysis notes the target was likely a Russian Su-35S multi-role fighter, which was downed on July 8th. The reports suggest the engagement utilized an AIM-120C8 AMRAAM missile.
Right.
Now, Ukrainian F-16s have already been up there successfully hunting down drones and cruise missiles, but, you know, taking down a crewed fighter in air-to-air combat is a completely different threshold.
Yeah, it is. But this raises an important question, and I want to push back a bit on the operational weight of this shootdown. It's historic, certainly, But do the defense sources frame this air-to-air kill as a strategic turning point in the trajectory of the air war? Like, does this mean Ukraine now controls the skies?
I see where you're going with that. And the military assessments actually provide a very explicit answer addressing exactly that. Okay. They conclude that, no, it doesn't fundamentally alter the balance of air power.
Right.
It definitely raises the risks for Russian pilots and proves Ukraine is getting highly proficient with Western systems. But strategically, Russia still retains massive numerical superiority in combat aircraft, and they maintain an incredibly dense web of surface-to-air missile coverage across the theater. One jet down just doesn't dismantle that network.
Which contextually aligns with the political posture we're seeing. Intelligence tracking reports that Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov is still reiterating Russia's maximalist demands, which are based on President Putin's June 2024 speech. They are not backing down.
Not at all. In fact, financial reporting cites sources close to the Kremlin saying Russia is actively seeking to establish a buffer zone and has zero intention of returning any currently occupied territories.
Right. A buffer zone essentially meaning they want to hold enough Ukrainian land so that their own birders are out of standard artillery range. Diplomatically, things are just as tangled.
How so?
Well, reporting indicates Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is claiming that unspecified agreements were reached with the U.S. at the August 2025 Alaska summit. But we have to contrast that directly with statements from U.S. Secretary of State Rubio, who went on the record in June explicitly denying that any such agreements ever took place.
Interesting. And if we look inside Russia's borders, the domestic conditions are incredibly strained, right?
Mm-hmm.
Open source tracking highlights that the Russian state Duma just passed a bill to recruit individuals with unexpunged criminal records for military mobilization.
Yeah, and economically, President Putin has been downplaying domestic issues in recent meetings. But analysts point out that this is happening alongside a sharp decline in the IMOX stock index, widespread reports of unfulfilled gasoline requests, and rising inflation metrics.
Wow. Unfulfilled gasoline requests in Russia.
Yeah, and that data was actually provided by the Russian Food Supplier Association itself.
That's very telling. And on the battlefield, the leadership is shifting. Reporting notes Ukrainian President Zelensky just appointed Major General Ihor Skybyuk as the new chief of the general staff.
Right. We're also seeing a massive informational disconnect regarding territorial control. Independent assessments state that Russian forces have seized 81.1 square kilometers of territory so far in 2026. However, the Russian Ministry of Defense is officially claiming they have taken 2,226 square kilometers. That is a staggering discrepancy.
I mean, how do you even fake a discrepancy that large?
Well, analysts warn that the Russian Modi is actively utilizing AI-altered flag-raising footage. They digitally manipulate videos to make it look like they've secured key towns, basically exaggerating their advances to project success to their domestic audience.
So while they're claiming massive sweeps, the reality on the ground is much more grueling. Tactically, frontline reporting confirms Russian advances in the Kostyantynivka and Dobropylia directions. But over in the Kupiansk direction, it's a totally different story.
Right.
A high density of Ukrainian drone activity is completely halting Russian advances there. They're targeting supply lines, which is compounding severe fuel and vehicle shortages among Russian frontline units. Like, the tanks up front literally can't move because drones are taking out the gas trucks miles behind them.
It's a brutal war of attrition on logistics, and military tracking details how deep these strike campaigns are going. Ukraine recently targeted logistics hubs in Krasnodar and Stavropol belonging to a massive Russian e-commerce company because those hubs are utilized to supply Russian forces with drone components.
Oh, wow. So they're hitting commercial infrastructure that's been co-opted.
Exactly. Ukraine also struck energy infrastructure down in occupied Crimea.
On the other side, Russia is still launching massive barrages. Defense monitors tracked a major overnight attack featuring 216 drones, one Iskander-M ballistic missile, and three KH-5969 cruise missiles.
Yeah.
The Ukrainian Air Force managed to down 204 of those drones and all three cruise missiles, which again speaks to that intense strain on air defense systems we mentioned earlier. And just as a quick regional note, open source reporting flagged that the Belarusian defense minister formally informed President Lukashenko that there was no imminent military threat from either NATO or Ukraine.
So we have this high-intensity kinetic warfare in Europe and the Middle East. But if we shift our focus to the Indo-Pacific AOR, allied forces are dealing with an escalating, yet currently non-kinetic maritime confrontation in the South China Sea.
Yes. Let's look at the South China Sea, because the tactics here are completely different from what we see in the Red Sea. International news agencies are detailing severe physical confrontations between Philippine and Chinese forces.
Right.
Out of the Second Thomas Shoal, there is a grounded WWII-era Philippine warship called the BRP Sierra Madre that the Philippines uses as an outpost. According to the Philippine military, Chinese Coast Guard personnel engaged Philippine Navy personnel in a physical melee using literally rods and oars.
Which is just wild to think about in a modern naval context. Mm. And a Filipino sailor actually sustained a head laceration during that clash.
Yeah. And in a separate incident near the Scarborough Shoal, reporting notes the Philippines accused a Chinese Coast Guard vessel of firing a high-pressure water cannon at a Philippine government fisheries vessel.
The diplomatic fallout from that has been swift. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, speaking at the ASEAN meeting in Manila, condemned China's actions as disturbing. He used that platform to strongly reaffirm Washington's defense commitments to the Philippines.
And the State Department also formally condemned what they call China's dangerous and aggressive actions.
Right. But the Chinese response, detailed in diplomatic reporting, is deeply entrenched. The China Coast Guard released a statement defending their personnel, claiming they only took standard, lawful interception measures.
Yeah, and the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson took it further, stating it was the Philippine boats that operated dangerously and fiercely attacked Chinese personnel. The Chinese embassy in Manila even released a statement accusing the United States of deliberately sowing discord and fanning the flames of tension in the region.
So what does this all mean strategically?
I think the best way to understand this is to look at the mechanics of the gray zone. The Chinese Coast Guard is using water cannons and hand-to-hand melee weapons like rods and oars. Why? Well, it's the geopolitical equivalent of a bully holding their finger an inch from your face and saying, I'm not touching you.
Right. Exactly.
They are area denial operations designed specifically to physically test territorial limits. They want to exert control and force a retreat, but they're doing everything possible to avoid crossing the threshold into conventional armed conflict, because that would trigger the U.S.-Philippine Mutual Defense Treaty.
How do the defense sources define the Philippine response parameter to these gray zone tactics? Like, do they need to ask permission to resupply their own ship?
Absolutely not. And that's the core friction point here. Hmm. According to regional reporting, Manila maintains a very firm stance. Their resupply missions to the BRP Sierra Madre do not require any permission from China.
Right.
This is rooted in the Philippine government's strict adherence to the 2016 arbitral ruling. That ruling, under international law, completely invalidated China's expansive territorial claims in the South China Sea.
Okay, to summarize the massive scope of today's operational reporting, U.S. and allied forces are actively managing simultaneous crises across the globe. In the Middle East, they are dealing with acute supply chain and energy threats driven by widening maritime blockades and intense kinetic strikes.
In Eastern Europe, they are monitoring a front line that is technologically evolving, like we saw with the F-16, but remains highly attritional and driven by maximalist political aims. Concurrently, out in the Indo-Pacific, those same allied forces are having to navigate these escalating physical gray zone provocations in highly contested maritime territories.
Thank you for attending this deep dive briefing of the Lowdown.
We want to leave you with a final strategic question to explore independently based on today's briefing. Consider the compounding logistical strain on global military supply chains. If the ongoing active maritime blockades in the Middle East ultimately intersect with the physical territorial disputes in the South China Sea, could that convergence potentially force a massive global recalibration of international naval asset distribution? Like, can a modern navy effectively police the Red Sea and the South China Sea at the exact same time? Something to think about.